Welcome back to What's at Risk. I'm Mike Christian.
'Cause it's witchcraft, that cuckoo witchcraft. And although I know it's strictly taboo.
From Arthur Miller's The Crucible. This predilection for minding other people's business was time-honored among the people of Salem, and it undoubtedly created many of the suspicions which were to feed the coming madness.
Oh no, must be the season of the witch, must be the season of the witch, yeah, must be the season.
Scholars of the Salem witch trials have long asked why the accusers chose to ruin so many lives. But author Catherine Howe asks, what if the women really were witches? What if the magic was real? In the novel, Harvard graduate student Connie Goodwin finds the name Deliverance Dane on a scrap of paper inside an old Bible. This discovery launches Connie on a quest to find out who this woman was, a journey that becomes even more compelling when she begins to have visions of a woman condemned for practicing physic or herbal healing on her neighbors in 1690s Salem. When Connie's boyfriend Sam has a horrifying accident, she realizes the only way to save him involves an ancient and mystical cure. Before time runs out, she needs to locate the actual physic book once owned by Deliverance Dane. As the pieces of Deliverance's harrowing story fall into place, Connie begins to fear that she is more tied to Salem's dark past than she could ever have imagined. The witch hunt was a perverse manifestation of the panic which set in among all classes when the balance began to turn toward the greater individual freedom.
We have found the witch, may we burn her?
Burn her! Burn her!
Who do you know she is a witch?
She looks like one!
Yeah, she looks like one!
Bring her forward.
I'm not a witch, I'm not a witch.
But you are dressed as one.
They dressed me up like this.
And
this isn't my nose, it's a false one.
Well?
Well, we did do the nose and the hat, but she is a witch.
What makes you think she is a witch?
Well, she turned me into a newt.
A newt?
I got better.
Burn her anyway!
Compellingly written, with powerful historic insight, The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane is that rare find, a literary first novel with a very commercial premise and pacing.
I took a black cat, a cave bat, and threw them in a pot, 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 pot.
Catherine Howe is completing a PhD in American and New England Studies at Boston University. Two of her ancestors were tried as witches in 1692. Elizabeth Proctor survived the ordeal. Elizabeth Howe did not. The idea for the physic book of Deliverance Dane developed while Catherine was studying for exams, walking her dog through the woods between Marblehead and Salem, Massachusetts. The witch hunt was not, however, a mere repression. It was also, and as importantly, a long overdue opportunity for everyone so inclined to publicly express his guilt and sins under the cover of accusations against the victims.
I'm casting my spell on you. I'm casting my spell on you. I'm casting my spell on you. You'll never, never be untrue. You'll never, never be untrue. You'll never, never be untrue.
We're speaking with Catherine Howe, the author of The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane. So the premise of your book revolves around the possibility that those accused in the Salem witch trials actually did practice witchcraft. Has that angle ever been explored before by historians or authors?
Well, it looks only at one of the possible Salem witches. So it only posits that the one named Deliverance Dane might have been a witch. And to my knowledge, I don't think that has been really widely considered. I mean, one thing that I was looking at while I was starting to research it, or that kind of spurred the idea for the book, was doing research into a a tradition called cunning folk that they had in England during the early modern period. And a cunning person was someone who was in your town to whom you could go for occult services, like water dowsing or finding lost property. And the most notorious thing that a cunning person might be able to do is unbewitch someone who has been bewitched. And there's some evidence that possibly a woman who lived in Lynn named Anne Burt in the 1670s might have had a reputation as a cunning woman. And so I was kind of interested that there was this heritage of sort of English folk magic. And I was a little curious, you know, if it were real the way that they imagined it to be, I wanted to imagine how it would look and who would do it and why they would do it. And so it just seemed like a fun, different way of exploring the Salem Panic.
Yeah, and an interesting angle, and one that seemingly would be obvious, right? Well, maybe they really were witches. You'd think somebody would have thought about that before.
Well, I think they show up here and there in popular culture. I mean, I think in one of the Harry Potter films, there was a Salem Quidditch team, if I remember correctly. And
oh,
so,
there was. That's right.
So I think it showed up before, but I was trying to look at it from the standpoint of the history, kind of bringing the history and imagination to bear on the Salem story a little bit.
What exactly is a physic book?
Physic is an archaic word for magic or for medicine. And one thing I was trying to do was look at the fact that during the colonial period, the border between science and medicine and faith and folk practice was a lot more blurred at that time. So you could have a guide for housewifery, for instance, that included not only instructions on how to make soap and how to prepare food, but also how to make a poultice for a burn or, you know, something like that, sort of practical medical skill. And some of those recipes include charms. And so I was also interested in kind of looking at this sort of folk practice. And we still kind of hold on to some of this stuff today. And one example I use when talking to readers about it is like chamomile tea, for instance. You know, is chamomile tea a food?
Right.
Or is it? Does it really taste good? I mean, not great, you know. And so why do we drink chamomile tea when we have a sore throat? And that is an example of something that's kind of in that same kind of overlapping category of not quite food, not quite medicine, not quite folk, but maybe all three put together.
Right. Where science and folklore and magic all kind of come together, huh?
Right.
There was an item in the paper about they had put up $200,000 to study witchcraft because they had found that some of the things that witch doctors had been teaching for ages had some definite therapeutic value, either psychosomatic or definite medicinal cures, and to see if the modern doctor could learn anything from witchcraft. And the reverse might be also true. I wonder how far the witch doctor has progressed, how many of the modern medical theories or practices he has adapted to his needs. And this is a witch doctor, and I'm sure like any other doctor, he gets a phone call in the middle of the night. And,
hello.
The crops are withering, and your son is seeing demons, huh? Yeah, there's a lot of that going around. I wouldn't worry about it. Yeah. Sounds like a 24-hour curse to me. Well, I'll tell you, if you're really concerned, do you have any bark of a tree that was struck by lightning in the light of a full moon in the medicine chest? Yeah, you might sprinkle some of that on him every 4 hours. Well, I'll tell you, if he doesn't feel better in the morning, why don't you bring him in, yeah?
Now, the main character in the book, Connie Goodwin, does extensive genealogical and historical research throughout the book. That's a focus in the book. And you obviously must have done the same for your book. Where did you do the research and how did you do it?
In order to prepare for Physic Book, most of the research that I did was actually in the history of the Salem episode and of the history of English magical practices and also folk practices. I did a lot of research in the secondary source literature, so people who are interested in reading some of these same history books, there's a list of them on my website, actually. So you can read them as well. Okay. There's also an amazing online resource. All of the documents pertaining to Salem specifically have been digitized by the University of Virginia. And so you can look at images of the actual court transcripts, trial transcripts, depositions, things that are held in archives all over New England, but have all been collected together in one place online. It's a really amazing resource.
The parallels between your life and Connie's life are interesting. You know, with the academic angle,
yeah.
And I believe you're actually related to two of the women that were tried for witchcraft in Salem.
That's true.
As you were growing up, was that a big part of your life? Were you aware of that, and was it something that fascinated you?
I found out about, first of all, I just want to say, it's the first novelist affliction where the story gets a little bit autobiographical, and I am definitely have the first novelist affliction. It was our connection to the Salem witches. There are two of them. Elizabeth Proctor is one who survived the trials because she was pregnant at the time that she was accused. Her husband, John, was put to death. And luckily for her, by the time that it's time for her to have her baby, the trials had burned themselves out. The other one is Elizabeth Howe, who has the same last name that I do. And she was accused by her own family, in fact, by her in-laws. And unfortunately for her, she was hanged. She was put to death. And so I found out about them when I was about 15, because my father's sister was building on some old research that we had. And of course, I responded like a 15-year-old girl, which was just to think it was completely awesome and totally cool and so forth. But I didn't think about it much more structurally until I was in graduate school and doing a PhD at BU in American and New England Studies. And I approached the story partly as a personal story, but primarily as a historian, I think, you know, trying to bring us in greater contact with this period of history that so many of us feel so connected to. I mean, it's such an anomalous time period in our culture, and I think it belongs to all of us, and I think that we all have something to learn from Salem.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was going to ask you, why do you think we're so fascinated with Salem and the witch trials? Because it's a story that just doesn't ever end and goes on and on. Do you think it's sort of that collective guilt maybe that happened at the end of it that continues to go forward with everybody? Or
well, I think there are a couple of reasons why we're never done with Salem. I think part of it is because the Salem episode requires us to question a lot of things that we like to believe about ourselves. You know, it's kind of a truism that we, as a culture, tolerate difference, for instance, not just religious difference, but also social difference or cultural difference. We also want to believe that we care about people at the very borders of our society, people who are very poor or people who are maybe insane or disagreeable in some way. And I think that Salem makes us grapple with those assumptions because it's pretty compelling evidence to the contrary, or that we all constantly have to struggle to remember to keep those ideals close because they can so easily be thwarted.
Right.
And so I think that part of it has to do with guilt, and I think part of it also has to do with our relationship with modernity. We think that belief in witchcraft is this mysterious holdover from the Middle Ages. But in fact, at that time period, it was against the law. We weren't just dealing with residual beliefs or superstition. We were dealing with a legal system that was built on an assumption that witchcraft was real. And I think that that's kind of hard for us to wrap our heads around. And so I think Salem has a lot to tell us about how tolerance is an ideal that we must actively strive to maintain.
In early 1692, Reverend Parris's 9-year-old daughter Elizabeth, 12-year-old niece Abigail Williams, as well as other neighborhood girls, began to fall into horrid fits. Their parents tried to discover what was causing their distress, and village doctor William Griggs gave his opinion that the girls were the victims of witchcraft. Put upon to tell who was causing their afflictions, the girls finally accused 3 village women, and warrants were sworn for the rest of Sarah Osborne, Sarah Good, and Paris's slave, Tituba.
Everybody prayed of the wicked old witch.
Soon, more accusations were made, and by the end of March, church members Martha Corey and Rebecca Nurse were also arrested, examined, and jailed. By May, scores of witches, both men and women, had been examined in Salem Village, and jails were being filled up with up to 150 accused persons from many towns, including Salem, Topsfield, and Andover. dozens of people under excruciating religious, civil, and family pressures found themselves confessing to being witches. In May, Governor William Phipps called a special court to try the cases of those accused witches who had not confessed. Convening in Salem in June 1692, the court quickly condemned Bridget Bishop to death. During July, August, and September, 18 people, including Nurse, Good, and Corey, were hanged. In addition, one man, Giles Corey of Salem Farms, died under torture. At least five others, including Sarah Osborne, died in jail. By the new year, the colony was becoming exhausted with the witchcraft frenzy, and learned people were speaking against the validity of spectral evidence being used in court. When the trials resumed, this former evidence was disallowed, and proof was insufficient to condemn any other accused. The witch horror was over. Of the 19 people who were executed during this tragic yet heroic period, 12 came from the Salem Village area, dying rather than confessing to what they had not done. Back with Catherine Howe.
Now, there were a lot of reasons thrown around for the hysteria of that time, and lack of tolerance being one of them, you know, from the tension between competing religions and all the way to, you know, I've read about hallucinations caused by eating moldy bread and things like that. What do you think actually caused that hysteria?
I think there were a couple of reasons why Salem happened. First of all, Salem was not the only witch trial that we had. I think there's sometimes this conception that this was a one-off event, and that's not the case. There are actually a number of witch trials both before and after. Salem was just the biggest and the most fatal. For me, I think it's most persuasive to look at a few factors together. There are some historians who've argued that it had a lot to do with the kind of factional relationship between the more urban, seagoing Salem town and the more rural, less forward-looking Salem Village, and their struggles over land and political influence and church establishment. And I think that that had a lot to do with it. There was definitely long simmering interpersonal problems in these communities that boiled to the surface. But I think also part of it was a historian named Mary Beth Norton makes a really persuasive case that there's also kind of an aftershock happening from the violence of the Indian Wars along the main frontier. She points out that if you look at the language that the colonists used to describe the devil, it's virtually interchangeable with the language used to describe the first peoples who lived here, the native population who lived here. And of course, in a world that is theocratic and Christian, everything that is not Christian is, by definition, devilish. And that would hold true for the native population as well. So if you have this very kind of violent surrounding area. I mean, we don't think of the North Shore and Essex County as being the border of the known universe, but at the time, that's in effect what they were. And you combine that also with a community under extreme internal pressure. I think you put those two things together, and something is going to happen. And it just so happens that the coping mechanism that they had in place was witchcraft.
Got certainly a way out of hand, though.
Definitely, definitely. But one thing that was interesting to me in researching it was You know, we focus on the behavior of the afflicted little girls, the little girls who brought the accusations forth, and why did they act in such a strange way with, you know, acting out and screaming and fits and running around. And definitely it's a compelling question. But what was interesting to me was to think about what kind of world sees a witch trial as the rational response. Because these were rational people. They just lived in a different intellectual universe from the one that we live in now. And so I was very interested in trying to imagine a world where the witch trial is the reasonable thing to do. The world looked at from the point of view that holds witchcraft to be actually, literally, real and not controllable in any other way. I mean, it's almost more chilling to look at it from the standpoint of a rational choice rather than the result of hysterical behavior.
Although there was a collective fear that built up over a period of time, right?
Definitely.
How long was that period of time, just out of curiosity, that this whole thing happened?
For Salem specifically or witchcraft?
Yeah, for Salem specifically.
It was an unusually long span of time. The first kind of incidence of bewitched behavior took place in January of 1692, and it was with Betty Paris, who was a 9-year-old daughter of the very unpopular minister of Salem Village, Samuel Paris. However, the first trial and execution didn't take place until June, and this is partly because of a weird sort of legal loophole that was going on. Because of political changes that were happening in England, they did not have the legal authority to try the people who were being accused of witchcraft. And so people languished in prison. And while they were languishing in prison, the fits and bewitched behavior spread from Betty to her circle of acquaintance, first in the Paris household and then into their broader circle of acquaintance. So they didn't really have the means to nip it in the bud, so to speak. And so by the time the trial took place, there were some judges who thought that the first person who was hanged for a witch was not the first woman accused. Her name was Bridget Bishop, and she'd had a bad reputation for a number of years. And so there were some judges who thought that hanging Bridget Bishop would bring it all to a conclusion, that it would be kind of like a, you know, that she was the one responsible, and that then the behaviors and the girls would stop and everything would be okay. But we know that that's not what happened, and only a couple of weeks later, another sort of swath of women, about 5 women, were put to death next. And so part of what made it so big was this fact that they couldn't act while the accusations were really happening. It just gave it a lot more time to grow. And the whole episode didn't really burn itself out until the end of the calendar year.
Some of your story takes place in Marblehead, which is right next to Salem. Does Marblehead have a connection to the witch trials?
It does, actually, in a couple of ways. First of all, for a long time, Marblehead was actually politically part of Salem. It didn't become its own township until, oh gosh, the 1640s, because I'm not remembering. But it was one generation into settlement. So for a long while, they were part of the same political entity, first of all. Second of all, Marblehead did have an accused witch from the Salem Panic. Her name was Wilmot Red, or sometimes you see it spelled Reed. In fact, Red's Pond in Marblehead is named for her. She was an older woman. She was accused and put to death in the course of the panic. And in fact, some historians have pointed out that calling it the Salem Panic is actually a bit of a misnomer, because it would be more accurately called the Essex County Panic, because there were witches from Marblehead, there were witches from Topsfield, there are almost as many, I think, from Andover as from Salem Village itself. And so it was really much more had to do with the region than with this one small town in particular. But the thing that makes Marblehead so special, and this holds true today, and which is why I found it so evocative, is that Marblehead has one of the largest assortments of 18th-century houses extant in the entire country. Our historic district is actually very unique in that regard. I think it's one of the few places where you can walk down the street and pretty easily, with a little imagination, wipe out all the cars and the asphalt and the power lines and superimpose what the community looked like when it was a bustling urban seaport in the 17th and 18th centuries. And so I thought that it was just a very fitting setting for a story that moves around in the colonial past because it's so incredibly evocative even today.
So what's next up for you as far as books?
I am currently at work on another novel that will be similar in tone and theme to the Physic Book of Deliverance, Jane, but is going to be set in a different time period. It will take place in Boston in the teens and is going to be also looking at a family of unique talents, although not a direct sequel to Physic Book.
We've been talking with Catherine Howe, and what's the website again, Catherine?
There are two. My website is www.catherinehowe.com, and the book's website is www.physicbook.com. And people can also keep up with me on Facebook and on Twitter.
It is such an ancient pitch, but one that I'd never switch, 'cause there's no nicer witch than you. Than you. Than you. Oh, you're a fine witch.
That's it for this week's edition of What's at Risk. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Catherine Howe, the author of The Physic Book of Deliverance Dane, and Frank Portman, the author of Andromeda Klein. I'd like to thank our producer, Johnny Pfister of Ringo Studio, and our associate producer, Scott Cooper. Let us know what you're thinking about by sending us an email at whatsatrisk@risk-strategies.com or leaving us a voicemail at 617-330-5723. Tell us what's on your mind.
Podcasts of What's at Risk are available at the WBZ.com on the air drop-down menu by clicking on What's at Risk. You've been listening to What's at Risk, heard every Saturday night on WBZ News Radio 1030 and streaming on WBZ.com.
Run the risk.